Which seems to be more important, rate control or rhythm control? And what are the latest recommendations?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer, which is better, a rate or a rhythm control strategy. There is some additional data that's come out with a rate control strategy. There was a recent trial termed a RACE-2, which looked at a very strict heart rate control. And rate control meaning that the patient is in atrial fibrillation during the entire time, but their ventricular response is controlled either, usually it's with a medication like a beta blocker or a calcium blocker. So a strict rate control, meaning heart rate's less than 80 at rest, versus more of a lenient rate control in which the heart rates are above that, but less than 110 at rest. Is there a survival advantage of one of those two strategies? And according to this trial, there's not a survival advantage. So I think some of the new data on at least a rate control strategy is that we can be a little more lenient in terms of controlling the rate. That's what I would add in terms of the rate control strategy. I don't know if you guys would like to add to that.
But. Well, no, I agree with you. I think that the RACE-2 certainly supports what you're saying. I think that importantly, we all have to individualize the care of our patients. And if they're very symptomatic, then a strategy of rhythm control is very important. If patients are frequently admitted to hospital because of atrial fibrillation, it was shown in the Athena trial that a drug like dronedarone actually reduces hospitalization, which improves the quality of the patient's life tremendously. And also cardiovascular mortality can be reduced based on the Athena trial with dronedarone. It hasn't been looked at with the other antiarrhythmic agents, so we don't really know. But I think the important thing, as Mike was pointing out, is individualizing therapy based on the condition of the individual patient and the disease state and the associated pathologies that the patient might have.
I think that's very, very true. It's very fair to say. The thing that's interesting is, despite all the knowledge that we have so far, it is really hard to answer that question, which is better, rate or rhythm? And I don't think there is an answer to that question. I think we'll go through the CABANA trial, the trial that Mike mentioned before, and we'll find certainly some very important information, but I still feel that what other Mike has said is very true. It has to be individualized. And I think those patients that are highly symptomatic are going to dictate a much more aggressive stance. At the end of the day, though, we have, to date, very little information that would support saying that being very aggressive at maintaining sinus rhythm is going to prolong life. We even see in the patients with heart failure where there's this intuitive feeling that, oh, if I can keep the person in normal sinus rhythm, their heart function will be better and they will live longer. That does not appear to be correct. The prognosis in atrial fibrillation and heart failure patients isn't really significantly changed by forcing the issue of sinus rhythm. And it's probably the underlying condition, the heart failure, the dysfunction, that dictates what the prognosis is.
I think what Cindy has just said is very important. And I support what she's saying. They do reflect exactly what the clinical trials have found. But it's very important, though, to realize that clinical trials provide aggregate information. They don't tell you how to manage an individual patient, and probably will never be able to tell you that, because they don't provide enough detail to provide you that information. So all of us have to look across the table at our patient and make an individual decision based on guidance from clinical trials on how optimally to manage those patients. And in my view, there's no substitute for that.
If you look just at rhythm control, how should cardiologists choose first and second line agents?
Well, that's an important question, because in 2011, the guidelines in the United States were changed. Now, guidelines are very important because they direct the clinician to optimal care. But it's important to emphasize that guidelines are guidelines. They're not commandments, and there are no absolutes. So in the antiarrhythmic area, there were important changes. And these changes were based on certain categories of patients. So the categories that were defined in the guidelines were patients with atrial fibrillation without structural heart disease, patients with atrial fibrillation that had left ventricular hypertrophy, patients with atrial fibrillation that had coronary disease, and then finally, patients with atrial fibrillation that had heart failure. And one of the most important changes from 2006 was the addition of dronedarone to the guidelines. And dronedarone was indicated for all categories except those patients who had heart failure.
I think that that was a very important addition to the guidelines, the introducing dronedarone to our armamentarium. And it is a very effective drug. It is an appropriate first-line drug for a number of patients. But as we all know, unfortunately, you often have to go on to the second-line treatment. So within the guidelines, depending on the heart condition, we have sort of a number of drugs that we can choose from. As you move down the line, if you would, from the more healthy patient population to the sicker person who has coronary disease or congestive heart failure, our options become more limited. We really have relatively few drugs in that category of patient that we can choose that would be appropriate. So a drug that might be very appropriate for somebody with a structurally normal heart, like dronedarone or flecainide, could be deadly in somebody who has congestive heart failure. So it's very critical that we look at those drugs and, even if we're going from first to second line, be very careful as we're choosing the drugs that we don't introduce something that could make the condition worse.
If I could just add, the structure of the flowchart for the guidelines is constructed such that the first and second line drugs, which are underneath the categorized patient, is based not upon efficacy but upon safety. So, and this was alluded to, that a drug, for instance, flecainide, is a perfectly acceptable first-line option for patients who have a structurally normal heart. However, if that patient has a previous myocardial infarction, then that drug is actually contraindicated. So the guidelines really help, to a large degree, structure that individualized patient into your prescribing a drug that would be safe.
I'd just like to add one point, and these are not included in the guidelines, but a recent study of patients with chronic atrial fibrillation with dronedarone had some poor outcomes with respect to safety. So it's very important, although not included in the current guidelines, that patients with paroxysmal atrial fibrillation be treated differently from patients with chronic atrial fibrillation, and we should not use dronedarone, in my view, in patients with chronic atrial fibrillation, whereas it is clearly effective in patients with paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, as demonstrated in the ATHENA trial.
I think that the guidelines are really, they're living documents. They keep evolving over time as we get more information. And they're written in a very careful fashion so that you're not jumping the gun and including studies that have relatively few patient populations in them. You're trying to keep up with the state of the art without introducing things that aren't well substantiated. So I think that that's important. And then, of course, there are the people who don't really exactly fit into the guidelines. The vagally mediated atrial fibrillation, how do you deal with that patient population? They're in there, but they're not dealt with specifically. Usually they are people who have structurally normal hearts and you tend to use the same drugs, but there are other drugs that you might not want to use in that circumstance. So again, guidelines are guidelines, they're not the law.
Finding effective treatment of atrial fibrillation certainly can be challenging. We had an opportunity to visit with Merrill, a patient of Dr. Ezekovitz. Merrill was diagnosed a decade ago with atrial fibrillation. For her, the problem is all about rhythm control. She got tired of putting up with the recurring episodes and even more the unknown of when it would happen again. She read about Dr. Michael Ezekovitz in the newspaper and went to him for a solution. Let's see what that solution was.
I love nature. I love walking in gardens and beautiful areas. I like to go out in the country. I'm 69 years old. There were times when I didn't think I would ever get to 69. I was diagnosed with atrial fibrillation almost 10 years ago. I was awakened from a deep sleep about maybe 12 midnight. I woke up and I felt my heart flipping, like it felt like it was doing somersaults. The next thing I know, it felt like butterflies were in the center of my chest, flutters. I knew I had to call 911 at that point. I got a call very early in the morning that she said, don't be afraid or don't be alarmed, but I'm in the hospital. And of course I was afraid, so I had to get down there. When I got to the emergency room, I was hooked up to their EKG machine. I had atrial fibrillation. You're wondering, you know, am I going to live through this? Am I going to have a stroke? Why is it happening?
Atrial fibrillation is an abnormal rhythm. It leads to an irregular heartbeat. So if you want to cure the patient of that rhythm, the approach is rhythm control. In Meryl's situation, because her atrial fibrillation is intermittent, it's all about rhythm control.
When I got out of the hospital, I went to my regular cardiologist, and he put me on a beta blocker. About 2 or 3 years went by. I had no episodes of atrial fibrillation. Then they started in earnest, and I mean like every other night. The worst part of having atrial fibrillation is the unknown. You never know when is it going to come back or if it's going to come back. The fact that I kept getting it again and again, and I began to say to the doctors, you know, I just don't want to keep putting up with this.
I have an appointment today with doctors.
In her particular case, her episode of atrial fibrillation was self-limiting. So the strategy was then to prevent her from developing recurrent episodes. And the drug I chose was amiodarone, which was the most potent agent.
I'm going to examine your ankles, make sure that there's no swelling here.
You have to decide whether you're going to adopt the approach of rhythm control or rate control. Usually early in the process, you try rhythm control first.
Hi. Tell me, what do I do to become a member?
Well,
I want you to read that.
He is the one who found the correct formula. When I went on the first anti-arrhythmic drug, I stayed on that 3 to 4 years, and it immediately stopped the atrial fibrillation. No more every few nights having to call an ambulance.
And then, unfortunately, she developed a side effect to amiodarone, and I placed her on a newer drug called dronedarone, which is indicated for patients that have intermittent atrial fibrillation. It seems to have much fewer side effects, and she responded very well. She does represent a success story.
Basically, I have a good life and a lot of nice friends. Meeting friends for lunch. I feel like my symptoms are under control. Now my quality of life is good.
Well, Meryl was a very instructive case. She had multiple admissions into the hospital because of symptoms related to her atrial fibrillation. And she was reluctant to take an antiarrhythmic therapy, as I recall. She checks the internet frequently and saw all the side effects related to amiodarone. But amiodarone was the only act in town at that stage. And I prescribed amiodarone, and she responded very dramatically and was very grateful for the response and had no further admissions to the hospital. And then, almost predictably, she developed side effects related to the amiodarone. These were, as I recall, pulmonary side effects, but she also developed thyroid abnormalities. So I switched her to dronedarone, and she's been on dronedarone, as I recall, for approximately 18 months or so, and also has not had any admissions to the hospital for atrial fibrillation or to the emergency room. And actually, she's a classic Athena patient. from the Athena trial, in that she had paroxysmal atrial fibrillation that was symptomatic, and she responded by having much fewer hospitalizations, none in her case, and improving her quality of life. And in addition, the thyroid dysfunction that occurred with amiodarone has now resolved now that she's on dronedarone. And one of the things that I'd be interested in hearing your opinions are, is when you switch patients from amiodarone to dronedarone, do you allow a time interval before starting the dronedarone, or do you do or do you switch these patients almost immediately?
In a way, it's harder to go from that direction, amiodarone to dronedarone, because you don't know with amiodarone what the right time period is to wait between stopping the one thing and starting the other.
Because the half-life is so long.
It's so long.
Right.
Right. The reason we're trying not to have too many different types of agents on board, or in this case, two different drugs on board that have this very similar mechanism of action, because you can end up with toxicity, significant toxicity, or combined electrical effects. But with amiodarone, as Mike is saying, it's such a long-acting drug that you don't know. If you were going to wait five half-lives before starting the dronedarone, after stopping the amiodarone, you'd be sitting around for months. I tend to wait a few days, but I'm not convinced that that's really getting the drug out of the system. But you have parameters that you can look at. You can look at the EKG, you can look at thyroid function tests, but predominantly the EKG to determine when it's okay to start the dronedarone. So I tend to wait a few days, but I don't have a magic answer to that.
What specific things would you look at on the EKG?
I would be looking for, what do you look for on an EKG with amiodarone in the first place? You look at the PR interval, you look at the QRS duration, you look at the QT interval, mostly the QT interval.
Right.
The QT interval being a reflection of what the deadly proarrhythmic effect or torsade, what the likelihood of that occurring is. If you're going to use two drugs in close succession that can have the similar effect on that interval, you want to be sure that you're not already showing problems with the first drug before starting another drug. It's easier going the other way, from dronedarone to amiodarone, because dronedarone has such a short half-life, or even transitioning from other drugs to dronedarone is easier.
In fact, now that dronedarone is available, I do tend to go the other way. I use dronedarone first, and if they failed dronedarone, which is a less potent drug than amiodarone, I do as you're suggesting, start them up on amiodarone. And also, a patient like her, if she had recurrent episodes that required hospitalization, and she was clearly very symptomatic, I wouldn't hesitate to discuss ablation, curative ablation, with her and refer her to one of you guys.